Hello, everybody. And I know for the last 4 weeks you've been hearing previous sessions that I recorded about the sacrament of the priesthood. You know, as Nick said in introductions to those sessions, that was because this is the season of ordinations, and many of us have been to them or seen them. And the man who I'm going to be talking to today has performed plenty of them, and he might even mention that when we go. But today I have the great pleasure of meeting with Bishop Walter Hurley, who is at present the Apostolic Administrator of our diocese, as everybody knows. Now, Bishop Hurley has a lot of things that he's done in his life, and if we don't cover them all, that's because although he is willing to chat about them, one of the things that he's made clear to me is it's his present role in this present dilemma that he would like to make sure he's conveying to people what we're doing, where we're thinking, where we're going. Because as an apostolic administrator, just as is the case as a bishop anyway, you're a shepherd. You're there to steer the ship. But the other thing is that, unlike most of the people who listen to me, Bishop Hurley is not used to my accent. So there may be times when he has to say pardon, and I wouldn't want anybody to think that that's because he's stalling or he doesn't like the question or something like that. It's because he wants to make sure that I have the correct enunciation on the right syllable. Okay, so. One of the first, Bishop, thank you for spending the time to speak with me and then also speak to the diocese
I'm
as
happy
well.
to do that. I'm happy for the opportunity.
Indeed, it wasn't my idea. It was you and Father Joe that thought this was a good idea, wasn't it? So I'm going to ask you a few questions, and then I'll let you run with whatever that you're going to say, unless I think by looking at time I start to think, oh no, there's certain things that we want to cover. But I think it would be really, really good that people who don't know you at all. So I knew who you were, but I didn't know that you and I shared the same queen.
That's
So
correct.
people now, their ears will be perking up and saying, what? Bishop Hurley's not British. But so what do I mean by that?
I lost my Canadian accent when I came to Canada,
Yes,
came to the
yes,
United
yes, you
States.
did. Yes, yeah. So you're born in Canada.
Yes, I was. In fact, it may be interesting to know just how did I get here?
Absolutely.
I was born in a city in Canada called Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I went to grade school there. That was pretty much the English section of the province. About three quarters of the province was French, and we lived in the English section. And then when
So
it,
were your parents Canadians or?
yes, they were Canadians.
Okay.
And then once I finished grade school, there was no Catholic high school there. And the pastor of our parish believed that it was very important that the young men there would become very fluent in French. And so I attended a French boarding school in Nova Scotia in Church Point, and I finished high school there. And then at that time, there was a recession going on in Canada, and my father had two sisters and two brothers that had moved to Detroit during the Great Depression of the late 20s. And so my father came here for work, came to the United States, and we lived in the Detroit area. And,
How old were you when you moved?
pardon?
What age were you when
I
you?
was about 17 when we came.
Okay.
So I had just finished high school. And then I worked for a couple of years. I worked for Manufacturers National Bank for some short period of time. And then I went to Sacred Heart Seminary and then to St. John's Seminary in Plymouth. and was assigned, ordained a priest in 1965.
Just going back, what was it like to come from rural Canada to industrial America?
Oh, it was an adventure, and I enjoyed it and loved every minute of it. It was not a burdensome thing.
How many siblings do you have?
I have, there are six of us in the family. I have a brother that's deceased and a sister that's deceased. I have a sister that lives in Halifax, Nova Scotia, one in Warren, Michigan, and one in Roseville, Michigan.
So that you're the only one that went into religious life?
That's correct, okay. Yes. Okay. And I was ordained a priest in 1965, so I've been a priest now for 55 years.
Well, I know, I was born in 65.
Oh my.
In fact, you, although I was born in December 65, yeah, but you are actually, there should be a congratulations because.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
June 2nd? Is that?
June 5th June was 5th, the ordination date.
Right.
And okay. Then I've been a bishop now for 13 years as well. And I have to say about my years as serving as a priest in the Archdiocese, my years as a bishop, they've been wonderful times. I wouldn't change them for anything. They've been times of adventure and excitement. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, everybody has their days and their different things that they might have wished they had done differently or whatever. But the reality is it's been a wonderful life, and I've had opportunities that I never could have imagined when I said I will when I get
to. So going back to when you were 17.
Yes.
Or I presume before that, can you tell us a little bit about your vocation journey?
We had a pastor in our parish that I had the greatest respect for. He was very bright. He was a leader in the community. He was a good pastor. He cared for his people. And I always looked up to him as kind of a model. And so I would say he was really the inspiration for my becoming a priest.
Did they, when you were high school in Nova Scotia, did the sisters there encourage vocations?
Well, actually, we had a community of religious men, the Eudes Fathers, operated the school. They operated a number of the French schools, both in Quebec and then the one in Nova Scotia. So it was not neither discouraged nor encouraged, but there were people there who modeled priesthood for us.
I went to junior seminary boarding school, and just curious now, because that's something we have in common, that having in our teens been around a lot of clergy.
Yes, that's correct.
So when you entered seminary, you knew that priests were not perfect.
They what?
They were not perfect.
No, that's absolutely correct. And actually, going to a French boarding school at that time was kind of like going to a reform school, except we paid tuition to go there.
Yeah. The boarding school I went to was a bit like that too.
Yes, it was very rigid.
It was.
Schedule. But it was a different era.
What time did you get up in the morning? What time was morning prayer?
I don't really remember that.
For us, it was 6:30.
Yeah, it probably was.
Yeah.
Yes.
And night prayer was at 8:30, I think. Years later, when I entered the Benedictine monastery, and the novice master said to me, "Do you think you can live this regimented life, Scott?" Mm-hmm. I looked at the timetable and I thought, it's not that different from when I was at school.
Well, this was not that, it was not a seminary.
No, yeah. Okay.
And so the school schedule was much more open than you would have had in a seminary. Yes.
Okay. So who ordained you?
Would have been Cardinal Dearden, the Archbishop of Detroit.
But he wasn't a cardinal then, was he? Or was he?
No, he was not. He became a cardinal later.
Okay.
About 4 or 5 years later.
Now, so I've got a list here of, if it's accurate, of some of your assignments. Now, there's a curious thing. So you were appointed the pastoral vicar at St. Dorothy's in Warren.
Yes.
Yeah. And you were there for the first 4 years of your. Then you were appointed the vicar for the Warren Centraline vicariate.
Yes.
You were a young man to get that position, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I had been ordained about 4 years. I was in my, what, early 30s.
Okay.
When I became that.
Then you became the pastor of St. Cyprian.
St. Cyprian's in Riverview.
Again, for about 4 years?
Yes.
And now, when was it that you were sent for further studies? Well, that was a lot later, wasn't it?
Well, it was a bit later. I was about ordained about 17 years.
Okay.
When I was asked to go to work on a degree in canon law.
So tell me how that unfolded and what you thought when you were asked that.
Well, I was always open to what I was asked to do, and it sounded like an interesting thing. I had been ordained 17 years. I was in a sense, ordained just before the council ended,
mm-hmm.
Vatican Council. And so I'd had the experience of 17 years and an opportunity to reflect on that and on my previous experiences. And so when I was asked to go study canon law, what I discovered was that Cardinal Sciacca had in mind that I would come back to the diocese once I received my degree to administer and be the judicial vicar for the diocese. Now, in order to hold the position, you needed a degree in canon law.
I see. Okay.
And the Cardinal was very committed to the work of the tribunal and the pastoral care of people who are involved in broken marriages. So the tribunal in Detroit was having some major administrative problems, and so I was asked to run the tribunal. And so I did, and then following that I became the moderator of the Curia for the Cardinal, and then became the I was like the chief of staff for the archdiocese. And then when the Cardinal moved to Rome, he said, you can stay here carrying out this job, or you can become a pastor. And I just felt that it was better to give the new bishop coming in an opportunity to choose his own staff. The Cardinal had made some very hard, necessary decisions within the diocese, and I would have been very identified with those decisions.
Okay, yes.
And so it just seemed fair to kind of do something different. So I became the pastor of Our Lady of Sorrows Church in Farmington, which was a parish of about 3,000 families with about 1,000 kids in the school. And I was there for 13 years, and then I was asked to be the Auxiliary Bishop of Detroit.
Okay, so we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. So Cardinal Sciacca, well known in the Diocese of Gaylord.
Yes.
Of course, because...
And very dear friend of mine.
Yeah, because he was the one who was instructed by the Holy See.
That's right.
To create this, this diocese. I believe he also was the one who came up with the idea of a CSA.
He is. And it's been a very... useful and very fine thing for the diocese, not only here because it's our central source of support, but almost all the other dioceses in Michigan currently have a Catholic Services Appeal.
Could you perhaps, I know this is a slight sidebar, Bishop, but could you perhaps say what it was like before CSA? The reason why I ask you that is because I tell people I came here from France. And I also lived in Italy, and I lived in Holland, and I lived in England and in Scotland. And most Sundays, there were second collections.
Yes. Well,
but people here, you know, had CSA for such a long time,
yeah.
People forget what that was like, I think.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, this was a new diocese, so there was a question of how the diocese would be funded.
Mm.
And there are different ways to fund a diocese. The one is... there is what's called a cathedraticum, which is an assessment of the parishes of a certain percentage of their income that automatically would go to the diocese, needed to go to the diocese. And then there often would be the special collections. Well, it was the Cardinal's view that there should be one basic source of income, and that would be the Catholic Services Appeal. So, for example, in the Diocese of Gaylord, there is no diocesan assessment of a certain percentage of the income, whereas in some other dioceses of Michigan, you have both.
Okay.
Both the cathedraticum which can be 6-7% of the parish income, plus a target of CSA. So it really was a very innovative approach, and it has served the diocese well. Prior to that, it was just, well, as you know, the parishes are expected to meet their targets.
Yes.
And so it raised the bar, if you will, in terms of fundraising in the parishes. And I think it, because of the increased resources that a diocese would have, they were able to provide greater service. So it was a very visionary kind of thing that he initiated. He was a brilliant man.
He was a close friend of St. John. He was a close friend of St. John Paul's as well, wasn't he?
Yes, and they became even closer once he moved to Rome.
Right.
They would visit and have dinner often on Sunday and a number of other occasions. So then he eventually moved back to Detroit after he retired. And, you know, we would see each other periodically. But he was a very dear friend of mine, and I admire him greatly. And, you know, like all of us, he had some rough spots too, you know.
You're right, like all of us.
Yes.
So just stepping back a bit to a somewhat unpleasant job that you had, which many dioceses weren't addressing, but they were attempting and did attempt in Detroit. Could you speak about having to deal with some of the problems of clergy misbehavior, and
yes, I'd be happy to comment on that. One of my recollections is when I was serving as chief of staff for Cardinal Shaka, or Archbishop Shaka, at that point, he said to me one day, there was a report that had been issued in Louisiana.
What years are we talking?
This would have been the late 80s.
Yes.
That I'm talking about.
So long before 2002.
Oh yes, long before 2000. And he said, now I want you to figure out what we should do here. And you're the guy in charge that when there's an accusation of sexual abuse of a minor, then you're the guy that's in charge. And I want you to be the one that makes the recommendations and that sort of thing. And so we developed some policies for handling it. And it was very clear right from the beginning that if any priest had abused someone, they were to be pulled out of the ministry, and they were. And they were suspended from their ministry. A notable change took place in those early years. And I think one of the first cases I had was in the early 90s, and it came to us initially through an anonymous tip, and we called the priest in. But in those early years, if you spoke to a priest about that, then generally they would acknowledge that it happened. That all changed in 2002, when once 2002 came in and the charter was established, then everybody that in any way was accused wanted to make sure they had a canon lawyer to represent them, and you got into a much more legal process.
Yeah.
You still had to deal with it. But what I can say is this, that as once we knew that someone had abused someone, they were pulled from the ministry. They were never returned to the ministry, that was not universal throughout the country, but that was our practice there. I think it's important to recognize too that there's a distinction between sexual abuse of a minor and consensual activity with adults.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so my role was to deal with sexual abuse of minors specifically.
Can I just ask that, when you first were approached about this, when Archbishop Shaka asked you to do it, first of all, in a minute I'll get you to reflect on the horror of having to undertake that, and how that makes you have to look at your priesthood in such a fashion to deal with something that we find repugnant, and especially repugnant when the clergy. But also, did that mean that you were no longer allowed to hear confessions of priests?
Oh, no. No, I was able to do that. I mean...
Did anybody ever try to get round you by getting to you first?
Never.
Okay.
Never.
Because, you know, that obviously is something that's become a concern since predators...
No, that the issue of sacramental confidentiality never was an issue at all.
Okay.
Generally, if the truth is known, priests didn't want to see me coming because they knew there was
no.
There was
so could you maybe share with us when you were asked to do that about how potentially upsetting and probably sometimes very upsetting it was to undertake this task, but also did you ever think when the Archbishop asked you, why me? Why am I being asked to do this?
No, I never did. Okay. I mean, I was asked to do it, and my response has always been to, when I've been asked to do things by the church, to say, oh yes, I'll be glad to do that. Mm-hmm. I'll do it as best I can. I have no regrets about, you know, saying yes in that sense. At that point, we were all in a learning mode. There were no, what you call best practices
there'd been no studies to
no.
look at these.
So it was there was a certain learning curve, and one was to be able to even convince priests that this is a reality.
Yeah.
Many of the priests did not want to believe that this could even happen.
Yeah.
People in parishes didn't want to believe that this could happen. We were early on, we established an advisory group that later evolved into the review boards that took place. We immediately pulled people out of ministry, and once they did, and we determined that their allegations had credibility to them, we never returned them to ministry. We learned along with society in a certain sense as well, the implications of all of it, which has been tragic in the lives of so many people. There's been so much hurt and so much damage done to the lives of people because of the abuse carried out by very few people.
Do you think that in the learning process, you know, I said to you once before when we were talking, that one of my brothers was a servant of the Paracletes back in, I guess that would have been in the 90s, and you know their whole ministry was to deal, and he looking back, he was a brother looking back, and this is my question to you, do you think that in many cases the church was too trusting of men who were bad, as opposed to men who got into clumsy circumstances, but men who actually were predators, that we thought as a church people would want to do the right thing, people would want to convert, and that was used by manipulative priests to further their own predatory aims?
Well, I think, first of all, it's we know many things today that we did not know back then, and it's easy for us sometimes to project our knowledge of today to what we might have should have known at that time. But there would have been a certain perception that when the church was dealing with issues, dealing with abuse, that they were dealing with sin. And certainly it is sin, but we're dealing with more than that. But the church dealt with it as sin, and so it was not uncommon historically in the past for sometimes a bishop to send someone to a treatment center for retreat, for prayer, for all of that, in a certain sense, not unlike what is sometimes done with various addiction training, like with, for example, drinking issues,
mm-hmm.
Alcoholism. You know, you send someone, you restore them, get them back functioning again. Well, what bishops didn't always realize, and even the psychologists at the time, believe that some could be restored to ministry. Now, we never did in Detroit, but that was sort of the notion. In fact, many times the treatment centers where the bishop sent people, they would recommend that people be given a certain ministry. And as you mentioned, the Paracletes would have been an example of one of those communities that would have done that. Yeah, not out of bad will, but out of the mindset that was prevalent at the time.
Now, you mentioned that in Detroit, you never allowed people to go back into ministry.
That's correct.
But you know, sadly, because there have been some lies told about you.
Really?
And and that's not why we're doing this. We're not doing this to confront certain lies that have been told about you. But some people in our diocese only knew your name because of a scurrilous accusation that was made against you, that you were party to an abuser being shuffled up here from Detroit. Now, I know that I'm not blindsiding you with this, because we talked about this privately, because I'd already knew the true story, and we don't want to go down a whole rabbit hole with this, but I think it's only just and fair, if you're willing, Bishop, to set the record straight.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I have no problem commenting on that one at all. The situation involved a priest by the name of Father Shirilla. I knew him well. We had been in school together. And quite frankly, once the first allegation came to me that he had abused someone, and we explored it briefly, he was immediately removed from the ministry. He was sent to St. Luke's in Suitland, Maryland at that time for treatment and so on. We never restored him to ministry in Detroit. He happened to be a very good friend, and having worked very closely with Bishop Cooney, Bishop Cooney agreed to, not only agreed, he made an arrangement where he came here to Alpena, I believe it was, and that he appointed him as to one of the parishes.
Yes.
And as I remember, once that appointment was made, then there was a big, a lot of publicity about that. But what needs to be clear is that, first of all, the Archdiocese, and I remember myself being absolutely astounded.
But let's also clarify, you were not a bishop at that time.
Oh, well, not only was I not the bishop, I would have no right or...
But I think that needs to be made clear.
I would have no right...
Because the accusations made are that Bishop Hurley did such and such.
No,
I didn't. You were not a bishop.
Well, not only was I not a bishop, even if I were a bishop, I would have no authority to overrule any decision that Bishop Cooney would have made.
Right.
Okay. Bishop Cooney made the appointment. I had no right to make any appointments at that time, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it was a very tragic thing. And as you know, Father Shirilla died in Alpena. I came to visit him one time when he was dying, and when he died, I came to the funeral that Bishop Cooney celebrated. You know, it's important for us to pray for the dead.
Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of the story there. I had no involvement in his being up here.
Now, what if people would say, well, why didn't Detroit tell the Vatican? You know, because people pick and choose how they want the church to work.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain why it's not as simple as that? You alluded to it by the fact that you had no authority, even if you'd been the Archbishop of Detroit, over Bishop Cooney, and how it's not as simple as why couldn't you phone the Vatican and they do something about it?
Well, first of all, the bishop is responsible. The local bishop is responsible. And Cardinal Sciocca, and he was the one who was at that time it would have been Cardinal Maida. He was the one that was responsible. He removed him from the ministry, prohibited him from exercising any public ministry. He could not represent himself as a priest. The archbishop acted. He acted on my recommendation, as a matter of fact, to do that. As he did in every case, you know. So the Archbishop did act. He acted very specifically. Now, at that particular time, it was very difficult. There was a sense of disbelief in the church that this could be happening. And there was, in a sense, a certain perception in Rome that this is an American problem.
Yes.
And so it was very difficult to have people formally dismissed from the priesthood because of the trials that you would have to have. And even then, it was unlikely that they would be dismissed. They would usually be assigned a life of prayer and penance.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think Cardinal Maida was very responsible, and I would have to say that both about Cardinal Maida and Cardinal Sciacca, that I worked very closely. They followed very carefully the recommendations that were made to them, and that is to their credit. Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on now to more pleasant things.
Sure.
So Cardinal Maida was the one also who asked you to be the project manager for the construction of the John Paul II
yes.
National Shrine. How did that come about? What was that like?
Well, the Cardinal's view was he was anxious to develop a center that would perpetuate and keep alive the heritage of the papacy of John Paul II. He had asked me if I would kind of spearhead that. He'd been working at it a couple of years and it wasn't really going anyplace. So he asked if I would take that over, and I did. And of course, at that time I said, well, I've got to take something off my plate. Mm-hmm. So we took the handling of the abuse cases off my plate for a number of years. And then I later came back in when there was a need to do that. So it was a matter of being very much involved in fundraising. A lot of funds were raised. The center was built. And then about the time that the center was dedicated, it was at the time of 9/11. And of course, all traffic to Washington just basically stopped. Tourism just died at that time. My responsibility was to have the center built. It was not my responsibility to operate it. And then as they began to operate it, they began to have some serious financial difficulties. And eventually, the Knights of Columbus purchased the center. It still is there.
Right.
And,
yes.
And it was an award-winning building.
And in fact, it was in the news a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
That's right. I think the president visited there, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And so again, it was an interesting opportunity. Prior to building it, we had a number of studies done that indicated that it was certainly something people would be interested in. But then as time went on, it proved that was not
indeed
to be the case. Yeah.
Okay, so then not long after that is when you were appointed the auxiliary bishop.
That's correct, yes.
Could you, as a kind of lawyer, but also as one who was a titular bishop, just very quickly explain what that is, but also beforehand, what it's like when somebody turns to you and you get a letter that says you're going to become a bishop? Or?
Well, actually, I got a call from the cardinal.
Oh, right. Okay.
Say, can you come over this morning? So I went over and he told me that I had been appointed the auxiliary bishop, and I felt very honored and very,
Had Detroit had auxiliary bishops before?
Oh yes, I was like the 22nd one historically.
Okay.
And so I went and he asked me, and I said, of course I would do that. And as I said, I was very honored. And then I had to write a letter accepting that I would do that. And it was a wonderful time. It was a wonderful time.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 66 when I was appointed bishop.
Had your parents already passed on?
Yes, my parents were both deceased at that time. There were actually three of us appointed at the same time, and none of our parents were alive. So that was kind of sad to me, too. Yeah.
It was, but hopefully their prayers in heaven were...
Well, I certainly believe that.
Yes. So, tell me about tell us about your love of, because you earlier on you quoted a line from Psalm 100 without probably even realizing when I said to you, what was it like to be asked to do to go to canon law? And you said, when I'm asked, I do things with a glad heart.
That's right.
Tell people about your motto. It's from Psalm 100
Oh.
and why that.
Well, when I was w one of the things that bishops traditionally do when they are appointed a bishop, they're assigned a titular see. Every bishop has to have a diocese, whether in reality it exists or not. So there are a number of dioceses in that used to be dioceses. And when a bishop is assigned and he's an auxiliary bishop or even an apostolic nuncio, they are assigned a diocese. And for example, one of the dioceses that they sometimes assign people is Sault Ste. Marie
Oh,
in
right. Okay.
Michigan. In fact, the
Okay.
Archbishop of Detroit had that as his titular diocese. Mine was Kuna Via in Albania, in the Archdiocese of Torres. I don't know exactly where it is. I never went there, but that was technically my diocese. And then the other thing that bishops are asked to do is develop a coat of arms. And mine is very
It is.
simple.
Yours is very simple.
It simply establishes like my place of origin. The ship that is on there is is actually the from the coat of arms of the province of New Brunswick, where I was born. The seven swords are from Our Lady of Sorrows, the church where I was at the time. And then the little things in red, I forget what you call it, epaulets or something like that. They were reflections of the traditional Irish Hurley family in Ireland.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's really a very simple thing. And then the third thing that you do is you establish a motto. I had a very dear friend, Bishop Arthur Krawczyk. We'd been friends from the time of my ordination, and he was an auxiliary bishop in Detroit, and he had chosen as his motto, "Serve with gladness," and it's from Psalm 100, as you know, and it never occurred to me to choose anything other than that,
Okay.
partially out of my respect for him, but partially because of what it meant, that our service to the church needs to be a service that's filled with joy, that we embrace, and that we do it in a spirit of gladness, you know? And so it just made sense for me to choose that.
Now, when you're praying the Divine Office, do you use Psalm 100 as an invitatory?
I think it often it comes up on
It does.
Fridays.
It comes up on Friday of week three, I think
Yeah,
it
I
is.
couldn't
And
remember
so,
which week, but
yeah.
yes, on Fridays. And I'm very conscious of that when I
Okay.
read that in the Divine Office.
Also, I think it's, well, it used to be one of the Psalms on Sunday mornings in the Benedictine
Okay.
breviary as well. So a traditional, somewhere like Clear Creek in Oklahoma, they'll be praying that every Sunday as well. So gladden, you're serving God with a glad heart. Can't have been always easy.
Pardon?
Can't have always been easy, or
Yes.
has it?
Yeah. I didn't quite catch what.
Well, to follow your motto, can't have been always easy. Because
I have
you've been
not.
a priest and a bishop through very troubled times.
Yeah. But you know, the reality is I haven't really found it that difficult. I mean, I enjoy being a priest. I enjoy being a bishop. You know, has it had challenges? Of course it has. Have there been difficult moments? Have I always handled everything perfectly? No, I haven't, you know. But I mean, I've always sort of had that notion of serving with
So it's
gladness.
like last week's gospel, you've yoked yourself.
Yeah, that's right. You
Yeah.
know, and you know, in fact, one of my very favorite scriptural passages, the passage from St. John's Gospel, where Jesus said, "When I was young, I went about where I would, And then when I grew older, I stretched out my hands and they bound them and took me where I would not go. And when I was ordained a priest, I never could have imagined the directions that my life would have taken. And I've always embraced those, and it's always been very enriching to me. And so sometimes when I have been asked to do things, I've always thought of that, you know, and it's been an important part of my life. And I think, you know, that sort of thing is really important for us today, you know, as we find ourselves in the church with so many things, not only church, but in our society, with so many things that burden us, you know, that the Lord is often calling us where we don't choose to go. And we value in our society today, you know, what I want to do and what's important to me, and so on.
A distorted idea of freedom.
Yeah, but yeah. But the response, our response to the Lord needs to be, you know, take me where you want me to go, you know.
Okay, so Grand Rapids came along. A daunting task when you were asked to take Grand Rapids. It's the second largest population-wise diocese in Michigan, isn't it?
Yes, I wouldn't use the word daunting.
Okay.
I would use exciting.
Uh-huh, right.
You know, okay. It really was. It was an opportunity that I did not, tragically, Bishop Britt, who had been my predecessor there, had only served for actually some few months before he died of meningitis that affected his brain. And so I had not expected that. I mean, I know when I was serving as auxiliary bishop in Detroit, I did not expect to ever end up as the bishop of a diocese. Mm-hmm. I had expected that I would just stay in Detroit, and my next move from where I live was going to be to the nursing home.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
But
that's been anything but that, has it?
It's been anything but that.
So yeah. You then, at the age of 76, you tendered your resignation.
That's right.
It was declined at first.
Well, basically, no, they accepted.
You are putting what do they call that when they do that with airplanes? A waiting pattern.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's accepted for now, and then it'll become effective when a new bishop comes in.
Does that mean that you have, including that, you have three times been an apostolic administrator?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I in the interim after the new bishop was appointed in Grand Rapids, I served as an apostolic administrator until he was installed.
Okay.
Yeah. So then after that, after I finished there, then I moved back to Detroit and I helped in a number of parishes there, some of which had some major difficulties, and different places and different times. And then,
did you also carry on helping with confirmations and things?
Oh, yes, I did. I would do a lot of confirmations.
So in effect, the Archdiocese had how many bishops then when you were there, when you went back? How many bishops were available to
them? Well, there would have been four auxiliary bishops.
Right.
And then I was just kind of the extra.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, one day when after Bishop Sistone died in Saginaw, I was asked to go there as apostolic administrator, and that was like October of 2018, and I was there until the following end of July, and again a wonderful time, a wonderful experience to be there, and then I went.
But there's some residual of and you may not want to talk about this, but there. You had to address at least one, if not a couple of issues there, that the public perception was actually very different from the reality. And you may not want, because it's not that long ago, you may not want to talk about it, but there were certain things that, you know, Bishop Raker, when he was explaining, when I've been interviewing him, he's explaining after he was appointed to Alabama, an apostolic administrator, what's it called, the nihil, He's actually supposed to just keep things steady.
Well, there's a distinction between a diocesan administrator.
Ah.
And that's the role of the diocesan administrator. The apostolic administrator has the full authority of the diocesan bishop.
Okay, so just clarify that. Explain both differences then, Bishop, if you would.
Well, sometimes the consultors of the diocese will elect someone from among themselves or a priest within the diocese.
So if, for talking sake, they'd elected me. Madness as that would be.
Yeah.
What is the difference between if I had been elected and the position that you're in?
Well, you would be very limited in what you could do. And that thing, nothing should change, should be there. As a diocesan bishop, you make the decisions that need to be made. No, you need to be conscious, and I am, of the fact that, you know, my time here is not permanent, and there will be a new bishop. So you don't want to do anything that's going to inhibit the further growth of the diocese. But I'm in a better position to be able to make the decisions that need to be made in order for the diocese to move forward.
Yeah, now, I'm really glad this has come up, because I don't think that people have perceived that correctly. I think people thought there was, no offense to you, there's an old retired guy down in Detroit who's done this kind of gig before, and the Holy See have brought him up.
Yeah.
There's a great advantage to having a retired bishop step into this role then.
Well, I know from the feedback that I've received from the consultors and the priests that I visited with, they're really quite pleased that this happened. Mm-hmm. In fact, if I'm not correct, if I am correct, I believe that they had expressed the hope that this might happen.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, you know, I'm 83. I was surprised too. But on the other hand, I'm neither in a wheelchair nor am I drooling at this point. So, you know, I have lots of energy and I love what I do.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and as you probably noticed, I haven't just been sitting around.
No, you have not. No, and thanks be to God for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to now, we'll follow that naturally into the situation that we find ourselves in just now. Yesterday, from us recording this, Governor Whitmer put out another executive order that has now, to all intents and purposes, I think it's fair to say, has mandated the wearing of masks, that people can be personally fined $500 if they're in a public place, a place that's allowed the public to come, and they're not wearing a mask. And on the way here, I stopped off in a gas station, and I was there last week on my way to see you, and now they have signs up saying it's mandatory you to wear a mask entering this premises as of executive order such and such a thing. Now there is, they're not applying that within religious services, but this might be another chance for you to clarify what your expectation is as the bishop and what the government, the legitimate government's expectation is, and why it is also an act of charity. And I know you've already explained this a couple of times. Bishop Raker, with me talking four different occasions, he explained this as well as in homilies. But it seems that yet again, we need the voice of a shepherd to tell us yet again.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an important question, and it's important because, again, the governor just raised it. But it's also important because when I met with the consultors here, the priests here, they indicated that there was a great deal of confusion about this within the diocese and a great deal of variation in the practice. Now, the legislation, if you will, whatever you might want to call it, the executive order, was binding, and that substantially has not changed. That was the executive order back then, that people should be wearing expected to wear masks.
Yes.
And I understand that there were some various communications that went out from the diocese here that kind of seemed to minimize that, which gave a great opportunity for people to kind of do what they wanted in that regard. So I think what I have done is, first of all, I've simply restated what is the requirements of the state, and the state does have a right to make
yes.
regulations regarding the public safety and the health of people. So I've simply restated that and saying, you know, it basically applies to us. The difference, of course, is that in churches, people are not subject to the fine or the criminal penalty, but that doesn't mean we're not obligated to observe
yeah.
the law. So, you know, you have that element that's involved. And I have noticed too, even when I'm out shopping here, substantial numbers of people don't wear masks at all. And the medical people have indicated the surest way to protect ourselves and protect people
mm-hmm.
Is to wear them. Do I like it? No, I don't like it. It's inconvenient, you know. But then when I have a choice about being concerned about other people or my inconvenience, seems to me I have an obligation to be concerned about other people.
Absolutely.
And to care for others. And so in my mind, our being faithful to that norm, the norms that have been established for our state, whether we agree with them politically or not, is irrelevant to me.
I think just on touching upon that, just to clarify for people, because the governor is pro-abortion, doesn't mean that everything she says
no.
we should discount.
No, no.
That's not how the church views
no.
things. It's not
no.
how
no.
It's apart from the fact it's a nonsensical way to think, but it's also not the way as a church
yeah.
that we conduct ourselves
yeah.
within society.
Yeah. And also, even just recently, I read in the paper this morning about a large gathering that took place at Torch Lake. That's within our diocese.
Mm.
And a number of cases have been identified as a result of that gathering. You know. So in my mind, it's the way we care for each other. And I think we have a moral obligation to care for each other. I don't want to be responsible for somebody ending up in a hospital or ending up with a virus because of my unwillingness to live with this inconvenience. I don't want to be responsible as the bishop of the diocese for creating a situation where, or fostering a situation that could evolve into people not being able to visit their dying parents in a hospital or a nursing home. No, I think we are bigger than that and greater than that as a church. So I really see this as an expression of our charity towards one another.
Do you think that this is perhaps, somebody was asking me this question, and you're an insightful man. I tend to agree with this, but I'm curious at your own observations. Is this a chance now, a God-given chance, for us as a church, as a faith, to be moral, once again, moral leaders within society? And this is God giving us a chance that as Catholics, where I'm from, in Glasgow, if people see you with your ashes on Ash Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
you could get verbally abused, because they know then you're a Catholic. There's something to be said here for people will know that you're someone who believes in the Lord because you're doing the charitable thing.
Yeah. I haven't made that connection, and I don't know that I necessarily would.
Okay.
But I just see it as an expression of what we need to do, and we need to do it because the Lord has called us to be concerned about each other. You know, and you know, as we read in the scriptures, being a follower of Christ is not always convenient.
Yeah.
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 And I think what's involved here is, of course, the whole, you have the political situation.
Yeah.
And I think we need to
we do.
Put that aside and look at, okay, what are we about? Who are we as a Catholic people? And we are a people who care about each other.
Yes. And I think you have people who don't think it's a thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. But it doesn't matter whether it exists or not.
Yeah.
Society thinks it is a thing.
Yeah.
So in charity, we have to care for each other.
Yeah, and we have some of the best medical people, epidemiologists, respiratory personnel are saying to us, this is what you need to do to protect yourself and to protect your people. In the same way, you know, we go to doctors because they know what we need to do to protect our health. They're telling us this, and we need to listen to what people have to say.
And I think going back to dovetail together what you've said and also what was in the governor's release yesterday, that if from the start of the advice to wear masks, if 95% of the population in the States had worn masks, the estimate is that 44,000 lives would have been saved.
Yeah.
It very much touches upon what you said powerfully there. No one should want to be responsible for the death of someone else over the slight inconvenience of wearing a mask.
Yeah, that's right. No, so I first of all, I want to really commend our priests who have been so supportive of this, you know, encouraging people to wear them, and I want to, you know, express a sense of appreciation for the people that have been so faithful in doing what they have been asked to do out of their care and concern for other people. Mm. And I'm not sitting in judgment on anybody. I'm just saying we need to appreciate those that have done so much. And I'm confident that, you know, our people will respond positively to these things as well.
Okay, so also related to this, I know you've had to hit the ground running here, and we need to be thinking about how are our schools going to be opening. So New York Archdiocese has said, I think they're closing 30 schools and amalgamating another 6 or something like that. And that's not the only place that that's happening. Now, I know we've had some good news about Blaine Amendment, anti-Catholic legislation going. We've also had some good news from the president saying that there's going to be some more money available which we can use for our Catholic schools. But let's be clear that there are none of our institutions that are free from harm during all of this. And to try and work out how to get our schools financially viable to go back, but also the safety of the teachers, the safety of the children. Any observations on that?
Well, yes, I think, first of all, obviously our goal is to fully open our schools, you know, but that has to be contingent upon the safety of the students and the teachers that are there and where we find ourselves as time goes on. Right now, there's a group of people here in the diocese that are working on various protocols that will need to be in place. But the goal is obviously, if it's possible to do it, the fully open thing. So I don't anticipate schools closing, you know. I mean, we have some very small schools. We have about 3,000 students in our schools, and we need to be concerned about those. And we have about 225, 250 people working in our school. We got to be concerned about them. So how does it all come together? So again, my sense is we look forward with hope. We try to put in place the necessary things, and we let the Lord take us where he's going to take us. But I am very hopeful and committed to the idea that the goal is to open our schools fully in the fall.
Okay, and you're actively, as you say, actively have people working on that.
Yeah.
Now, you're a very hands-on manager.
Pardon?
You? You're a very hands-on manager.
I've been described in that way.
Yeah. and that's fair enough. Everybody has their own different management style.
That's right.
And by the very nature of a smaller diocese, although geographically we're pretty big, we're small in numbers.
That's right.
Have you found that has actually, unlike the size of Detroit, the size of Grand Rapids, and to a certain extent the size of Saginaw,
mm-hmm.
this smaller web of people, has that dovetailed better with your hands-on approach, do you think?
Well, I think you I think it's always helpful to, have somebody that's kind of managing things, so to speak, or overseeing things. In terms of the various dioceses, in many the diocese is a small diocese in terms of population,
Yes.
but the difference is that the population is more spread
Yeah,
out.
absolutely.
And for example, Saginaw, Grand Rapids, they have a territory of about 7,000 square miles. The territory for the Diocese of Gaylord is about 11,000 square miles. And in places like Grand Rapids, you're not as about to run into an overturned trailer with loaded with cattle to close the freeways down
Yeah.
for hours, or so it's a different thing, and it takes longer to get places,
Yes.
so there is clearly a difference, but it has more to do with the size of the territory than it does, the number. Actually, we have more parishes here than say, for example, the Diocese of Saginaw does, because all of a number of years ago, when Bishop Rose was here, he made all of the missions
Oh,
parishes.
yes, right.
So we have, I think, 74 parishes, which is a large number for this for the size of the diocese. So they're very different, but each one has its own special character.
So you're trying to celebrate Mass in a different parish each
Yes, I'll be going out to two
Sunday?
parishes this weekend.
Oh, so you're doing
Yes,
two.
I'll do one on Saturday, one on Sunday, and then I try to meet with the pastor afterwards if it's possible. I think the following Sunday, I think I'm going to be away that weekend, so I won't. But generally, while I'm here, I'll be visiting parish. Now, I obviously will not get to all of them. Some people have asked, how long will I be here? And really, there's no answer to that other than that the nuncio had told me it would be for some months,
Right.
whatever that happens to
Yeah.
be.
Yeah.
And then I remain as apostolic administrator until the new bishop who has been appointed actually is installed as the bishop.
Right.
He may be announced about 2 months before and then installed within about 2 months or so. But so it's a wonderful place to be, and I'm really enjoying myself up here, and I understand it's even better being up here in the summer than it is in the winter.
Well, I prefer the winter myself, but that's but I'm a foreigner. So but this you going out to the parishes actually means that you're going to see how well or not things are being applied.
No, I'm not going out there as the policeman.
No, I know you're not going out as a
No,
policeman,
no.
but sadly there may be times where you might have to
Well, no, usually what happens when the bishop comes, they clean things up a little bit.
Yeah, I believe that.
No, but generally though, see, I'm not starting out with that mentality at
Yes.
all.
No, I know. I
It,
know.
it's
Yeah.
that basically, I have great respect for the pastors and what they're doing, and they're doing their best, and it's difficult being a pastor in the parish today. People have many expectations, that some of which are reasonable and some of which are not, and so you're dealing with it on a daily basis. So, a great respect for the priests of the diocese.
Okay, so as we bring this to an end, I have two questions for you.
Sure.
They're left field questions, right?
Sure.
So one of them is, could you explain to people what it is to be a member of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem? And is that why you have a horse here in the house?
Well, the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre is a group of people, essentially, who provide support for the Holy Land. And it's set up as kind of a knighthood. It goes way back. I don't recall the exact history of it. They meet about once a year in different places. And it generates support for the Holy See. And
Yeah, I think we have a another Knight of the Holy Sepulchre here within the diocese?
Yeah, there probably are a few. There are not a lot of them, but many of the bishops are, and I happen to be one of those. Yeah.
And okay, so the other completely left field question is, how did you get the middle name Allison?
I don't know.
Oh, make something up then.
I think I was named after somebody that my parents knew. Some friend or something. I don't know that for sure. I never did really get an answer to that question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was looking at you, I was wondering if it was your mother's name or something.
No, it was
not. Or
your
grandmother's name or something.
No, it was not. So I'm not really sure who I was named after. I think it was somebody that my mother had some respect for and admiration for.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
but that's the best I know.
Okay. So hopefully you'll find out when you get to heaven, God willing.
God willing, I get there, and then maybe I'll find out too.
Yes. Okay. So, Bishop, any closing remarks you want to make? And then if you could end with your blessing.
Sure.
And thank you very much for spending the time to do this and
yeah.
speak to the diocese.
Well, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to do that. And I just want to say how honored I really feel to be serving here in the Diocese of Gaylord, and how grateful I am for the extraordinarily warm welcome that I've received from the priests and the people that I've had contact in the few parishes that I visited. So it's been a great experience. So I did not expect to be doing this, but it's sometimes it's the result of when you serve with gladness, you get great blessings too.
Oh, amen.
Yeah. So let me give a short blessing here. Lord God, we ask you to watch over this diocese in a special way. Send your spirit upon those who must choose a successor to serve here as the bishop, and bless me in my ministry, bless the parish priests who serve and all those who serve in our parishes, bless the people of this diocese who live their lives of faith and those who struggle with faith, and we ask all of this through the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.